Heart of the Matter is brought to you by Dundalk Christian Counselling Centre. This free counselling service is situated at Dundalk Baptist Centre on RTE Terrace. You can contact us in complete confidence on 932 7094 or email us at christiancounselling@aircom.net. You can also visit our website at dundalkbaptistchurch.org/counselling.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Heart of the Matter on Dundalk FM, your community, your radio. And I'm glad to say we're back to full strength this evening. We have Stephen Murphy in the studio. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing well.
And we have Michael Amadi as well.
Trying to get back into the flow of things. Hopefully I remember which end to talk into here.
Yeah, it's been quite a while, Michael, and you've had quite an adventure in the States. So it's always good to have you in studio. This evening, of course, we start with a piece of music, and it's Jesus at Your Name We Bow. But Stephen, you're looking at Luke chapter 8 this evening, isn't it?
Yes, and we're looking at the incident where Jesus and the disciples are on the boat and the storm comes and then what happens next.
So that'll be interesting. So if you have a Bible with you, turn to Luke chapter 8 and we'll come back to you right after this song, Jesus at Your Name We Bow.
Yeah.
Now, we've been looking at Jesus teaching on the importance of the word as he brings God's word to the people, the need to believe it and to obey it. And this has been pressed home to them by the parable of the sower, the parable of the light. And also that true relationship to Jesus, as we saw last week, is shown not by being part of his earthly family, by being genetically related to him, but by hearing and doing the word of God. Now, this evening we follow this up with a very dramatic incident in which we're reminded again of who this Jesus is. Who is this Jesus who makes these tremendous claims? And his power, and particularly the power of his word, is very, very vividly demonstrated. So Luke 8:22. Now it happened on a certain day that he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side of the lake." And they launched out. But as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in jeopardy. And they came to him and awoke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. But he said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid and marveled, saying to one another, "Who can this be? For he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him." Now, to us, very often the idea of the sea is sort of a restful, almost a romantic image. And yet in Hebrew thinking, it was more often a symbol of chaos and something which a man had no control over at the beginning of creation. The very first act of creation is God, as it were, taking control over the chaotic waters. The Spirit of God hovers over the waters and speaks, begins to speak creation into being, "Let there be light." So I think we have to have this in mind more than our normal picture of the sea and the water as being somewhere where we go down with our bucket and spade and sort of make sandcastles. This is not what's in view here. But of course, from Genesis 1, we see that it's God who has power over the waters. And later on in Genesis 6 on, whenever we have the account of the flood, it's God who brings the flood. It's God who preserves Noah and his family in the midst of the flood. It's God who causes the waters of the flood then to recede, and for this new humanity with Noah and his family to take possession of the earth again. So God preserves his people in the midst of the threatening waters. And we're going to see how this pretty clearly then demonstrates exactly who Jesus is in his power over the waters. The Old Testament, of course, is full of references to God's power over the sea and his ability to preserve his people from its deadly power. Let's just look at some of them. "You who still the noise of the seas, the noise of their waves, and the tumult of the peoples." Psalm 65. And then in Psalm 89, God is addressed this way: "You rule the raging of the sea when its waves rise. You still them. You've broken Rahab in pieces as one who is slain. You've scattered your enemies with your mighty arm. The heavens are yours. The earth also is yours. The world and all its fullness. You have founded them." Then in Psalm 104, "The water stood above the mountains." Speaking here of the flood. "At your rebuke, they fled. At the voice of your thunder, they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys. To the place which you founded for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth." And then in Psalm 107, so speaking of those who call out to God, "Then they cry out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distresses. He calms the storm so that its waves are still." And so the Jewish people would have been, and Jesus' disciples no less than anybody else, would have been familiar with all of these references to Yahweh, to the God of Israel, and his power
over the seas, over the waters. And it was, you know, one of the defining characteristics that, unlike the pagan gods who had powers in certain areas, he was lord over everything because he was the one unique, the only creator god. And as they cross the lake in the storm, you have this awesome picture of Jesus being asleep. Why? Because of who he is. He's totally untroubled, totally unthreatened by the raging sea. Because even before he demonstrates to them his power over it, he's conscious himself of his power over it. Now we're going to come back and look a little bit more at this after our next song. And this one's called There Is a Higher Throne.
Thunderous as the rains through air.
Well, we were looking in the first part of the show about how Luke demonstrates who Jesus is by very, very clearly comparing him to what God does at creation, where he brings order out of the chaos of the waters, how God had also delivered Noah and his family from the flood, and humanity, this new humanity, was preserved through that. But there's another picture, of course, perhaps the most famous picture that comes to us from the Old Testament of God's power over the waters, and that's at the Red Sea. As well as demonstrating Jesus' identity as the creator in Genesis and the one who preserves Noah, he can also be seen here as the redeemer of Exodus. We remember in the Exodus, as God leads his people into new life, they face many, many challenges. And the most memorable, of course, is the one where they are standing on front of the impassable Red Sea. Pharaoh is bearing down on them with his horses and his chariots. And then God tells Moses to stretch out the rod across the waters, and they open up, and the children of Israel go through on dry land, and the same waters destroy their enemies. And this is referred back to again and again in the Old Testament. In Psalm 77, for example, it says, "Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You walk through the sea with your horses, through the heap of great waters." Habakkuk 3:15. And then Nehemiah says, "You divided the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and their persecutors you threw into the deep as a stone into the mighty waters." Of course, one of the other not so edifying things that comes out of the Exodus is the lack of faith of God's people, even though God demonstrates who he is over and over again. And in many ways, the disciples here reflect that, I suppose, instant resort to panic as soon as something goes wrong. The panicked cries of the disciples, in a sense, echo the cries of Israel at the Red Sea. It says, "So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord." Now, it's interesting what happens next. Jesus does address the whole issue of faith, or more particularly, their lack of faith. But before he does that, he deals with that which is terrifying them. He powerfully rebukes the wind and the waves. In other words, he speaks to them and they obey. His words, the words that he's been teaching the people, are so important, which they need to believe and build their lives on, like a man who builds his house on the rock. His words have power to change things. They have power over the things we fear. They're powerful over the things over which we have no power. And we're reminded, aren't we, that his word is not just powerful in those situations. It is, of course, but it's powerful in all situations. I'm reminded of what the writer to the Hebrews says, "For the word of God is living and powerful. It's sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart." We could look too at in Isaiah 55, where it says that just as God's ways are so much higher than our ways, so is his word, which comes down from heaven. It's powerful. It doesn't return there without accomplishing that for which he has sent it. Now, all of these things, of course, come into focus in the person of Jesus. He not just brings the words of God to us, as the other prophets did. He personally is the word himself. So there's that much more intimate connection between the word of God when he speaks, because he himself is the source of that word. So the same word that is the seed that is sown, that we looked at a few weeks ago, the same word that is the light that must not be hidden, but that brings change to people's lives and to the world all around, is the same word that powerfully stills the storm.
And so he rebukes his disciples for their lack of faith, because, you know, they've been with him for some time now. They've seen him demonstrate over and over again who he is. And on one level, I suppose, like ourselves, they believe it. They are believers. They're not unbelievers. They're not remaining to be convinced. But sadly, like ourselves, when something happens that either we don't anticipate or hasn't been according to our plan, we somehow think, well, it must be out of God's plan as well. Because we can't control the situation, we make the erroneous conclusion that the situation is out of control. But look here, firstly, Jesus delivers the disciples, and after that, he gently rebukes and uses it as a teaching opportunity. And this, of course, is grace in action. He challenges his disciples to have faith, renewed faith, in who he is, the authority of his word. And he gives them a fresh reason to do that in demonstrating who he is by saving them from this disastrous situation. Now, we're challenged, aren't we, as well, by the scriptures to walk by faith and not by sight. Now, that's very easy to say, but what does it actually mean? Throughout, I suppose, the rest of our lives, we walk by sight, don't we? We take on board and our attitudes are formed from the signals we get from the environment around us, and that's usually a good thing. But where that is set aside, of course, is when it comes to spiritual things, because we're depending on the word of the God who we cannot physically see. But what we're not walking blindly at the same time. So walking by faith and not by sight does not mean, as you might think, that we're walking blind. Rather, we're putting our trust in the character of God that has been revealed to us in the person of Jesus, in what God has done in and through his word as it's recorded for us in the scripture, how we've seen that, you know, in the lives of other people, and if we're Christians, how we can look back and see what he has done in our own lives. So we walk by faith, not by sight, on the basis of God having given us ample reason to do so. So our faith is not a leap in the dark, but it's actually a walk in the light. It's tracing our way through life, following the direction that God has given us in the life, the death, the resurrection, the ongoing ministry of Jesus in our lives. We have been saved as dramatically as these disciples were saved on the Sea of Galilee. And it's the one who, as he describes himself in Revelation, who was dead and now is alive forevermore, who has the keys of death and Hades, who not only has conquered the raging sea, but has conquered raging of sin and death itself, who challenges us, as he challenged the disciples on that day so long ago, to believe in him and to follow him. It always comes back to the question, doesn't it? All that being said, what are you going to do? We're going to go to an ad break and we'll be back to talk a lot more about this after the break.
Heart of the Matter is brought to you by Dundalk Christian Counselling Centre. This free counselling service is situated at Dundalk Baptist Centre on RTE Terrace. You can contact us in complete confidence on 932 7094 or email us at christiancounselling@aircom.net. You can also visit our website at dundalkbaptistchurch.org/counselling.
Dundalk Baptist Church meets at the Baptist Centre on RTE Terrace. On Sunday morning, we get together at 11 a.m. for our main worship service.
On Sunday evening, we meet at 6 p.m. for Bible study.
We'd love to see you there.
And we would love you to get in touch with us here on Heart of the Matter on Dundalk FM. You can contact us on Facebook on Heart of the Matter on Dundalk FM, or you can email us here in the studio at heartofthematter@dundalkfm.com. You can listen to the show online on www.dundalkfm.com and click the Listen Now button. You can also podcast this particular show on our website, www.dundalkbaptistchurch.org. If you have a mobile device, you can scroll down to the point where it says podcasts, and you can sign up for the podcast there with iTunes or with the with a third party Android app which supports the podcasts from iTunes. You can also stream the show live from the website at www.dundalkbaptistchurch.org/heartofthematter, and you can you can listen in to older shows as well by streaming them live. And so we come to the point in the show where we bring greetings to people who are listening in from different places. And there are so many people listening in from all over the world to the show, not only to the podcast. I know Adriana is listening to the podcast in California, and perhaps Anna is too in Florida. We have others who are listening to us in Michigan and in Maine. Phil is listening to us in Washington State. There are folk listening to us in El Salvador. There's also some folk listening to us in California as well, in Los Angeles. So hopefully you're all enjoying the show there. Then there are folk listening to us in North Africa, in New Zealand and Australia, in Beijing and India. There's some folk listening to us in Hungary at the moment. So hopefully you're enjoying the show. We also have some special guests in the studio. So you can listen in to the show from Hungary on any of those ways that I've mentioned. We have some folk listening to us from the Czech Republic, from Spain, from the UK. We have Matthew, who's listening to us in Inverness. Imperator and Pauline are listening to us in the West Midlands. Marinus is listening to us in West Yorkshire. And there are other folk listening to us from the UK as well. We have other folk listening to us in Ireland too. We have some listening to us in the Greater Belfast area, around Lisburn and Temple Patrick, in Enniskillen, then across into Galway, Limerick, Cork, Laois, Dublin. And of course, we have a number of people who listen to us around the town on Dundalk FM on 97.7, almost in the middle of your dial. So we do hope that you're enjoying the show. Do get in touch with us, and we'd love to hear from you and give you a shout out here on Heart of the Matter.
Well, Stephen, this is one of those passages where you feel like a thousand strands of biblical narrative are kind of coming together.
And in such a small piece.
And you can't say everything at once, so you got to kind of pick and choose what you want to say. But let me just start off with giving one more Old Testament text, and what I think is probably the primary subtext, if you will, the primary story upon which is being drawn from here, and that's the story of Jonah. It was probably a year and a half or so ago, if I remember right, that we actually did a couple series on Jonah. But if you think about the story of Jonah, Jonah is not primarily about a disobedient prophet who's running away from God because he's angry and, you know, he's having a fit or something like that. But it's a story about new creation. It's a story about what will happen when God does, as Isaiah says, this new thing, and it's going to bring in the Gentile world. And so we think of the story of Jonah. He's running away from God. He gets on a boat. A storm goes on. And where do the sailors find him? But he's asleep, right? And so they come and they're frantic. They want to know, you know, they're crying out, pray to your God that he'll save us. And he tells them, well, I know what's going on. You know, I serve the God who created the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. You got to throw me over. And then it'll stop. So they throw him over. The sea stops. Those on the boat now are amazed, and they start worshiping Yahweh and offering sacrifices. And now to skip to the kind of the end there, what happens with the fish? The fish spits him up on dry land. And who's on this dry land but Gentiles, these the Ninevites? And so the whole story is constructed around a new creation. He comes out of this chaotic water onto dry land, the same word that's used in Genesis 1. And who's on this new land but Gentiles? And so when we come to this account in Luke,
that whole theme is undergirding this entire thing. And you're right to point out Exodus narrative here. I think whenever we see a body of water being crossed, we should have in our minds Exodus and thinking through that. So what do we have here? The same story with Jonah. So they're crossing the boat. Jesus is asleep. The storm comes. They go and wake him. They say, we're all perishing. I mean, that's what the sailors on the boat to Jonah were telling them. But instead of Jesus saying like Jonah, well, you need to toss me over, he does something amazing. He stands up himself and rebukes the wind and the waves, and they stop. Now, only, like you said, only Yahweh, only God has that power to address creation itself and stop it. But what's interesting is, as we continue on, I mean, for the sake of time and kind of just a good little chunk to deal with, we can't go on, you know, and deal with everything else. But what comes right after this story? Where do they land? They land on Gentile territory. And so this crossing is not just, well, Jesus is in a boat, he's going on to the other side of the water. It is an Exodus account going to this new land, just like Jonah. And on this new land, who is there but Gentiles? And what does Jesus do for these Gentiles? He casts out demons. He heals them. Everything he's doing with the Jews in their territory, he's now doing with the Gentiles. And so the whole story is ultimately about the new Exodus is coming about. It's the new creation. And when this happens, the Gentiles will be brought in, and we'll see that...
which is one of the big themes in Luke's gospel.
Which is one of the big themes in Luke's gospel.
And of course, in the Acts, of course, as well.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the whole structure around this is not, you know, just Jesus crossing a storm, but we need to be thinking in those categories of new Exodus, new creation, Gentiles being brought in. And that's why I thought some of your Psalm references were I think, right on, because Psalm 65:7 that you quoted, you who still the noise of the seas, the noise of the waves, and the tumult of the peoples. I mean, we see the immediate reference that, okay, God is the one who stills the waves. But what is that whole psalm about? The whole psalm is about God's salvation and bringing in Gentile people. And so in verse 5, we read, O God of our salvation, the hope of all the ends of the earth. And then in verse 8, so that those who dwell at the ends of the earth are in awe at your signs. And so what do we have when he crosses the sea? Well, now he's at the ends of the earth. He's on Gentile territory, and they're amazed at what he's done. He's cast out demons, and they're in awe. Again, Psalm 107, you quoted 28 and 29 about he calms the storm so that its waves are still. And even in that particular psalm, there are Exodus themes about God commanding the wind to bring up the waves so that they stand like walls, and then the seas come crashing down. And then there's also new creation imagery of deserts being turned into pools of water. And so I think those are appropriate references to draw into this account, because they help shape the entire story that, yes, Jesus it does rebuke the wind and make it calm, and that is a mighty work. But what does that mighty work mean? It means that God has indeed returned to Zion, come in the person of Jesus. The new Exodus, the new creation has now begun. Gentiles will be brought into the fold. And so now what God has said would happen one day is now coming to be realized.
It's interesting, a thought came to my mind there, that whenever the religious leaders challenged them to give him a sign, he said that no sign would be given except the sign of Jonah.
Mm.
So he very consciously refers back.
He does. He does. And, you know, I think most people just kind of stop. You know, I think in Matthew, if it's Matthew, if I remember correctly, he says, well, you know, it's 3 days, three nights in the grave, belly of the fish. So mm-hmm. the Son of Man will be 3 days, three nights in the grave. And we kind of leave it at that. And you say, okay, yeah, it's just this 3 days thing. But he even goes on to talk about the Babylonians and how they repented. And so the whole sign is not just, well, he's in the grave 3 days, but the entire narrative of Jonah, which is that when God does what he said he would do, the Gentiles will be brought in. Now, how will you respond when he does that? When the people who are persecuting you, when the people who are lording over you, now find faith in Yahweh, the one who created the heavens and the earth, and are now going to worship him, what will you do then? And I think ultimately that's the question that is posed to the Jews in the book of Jonah, is what will you do when this happens?
All right, on that note, we're going to go to our next psalm, which is Name of All Majesty.
Stephen, as you are going through the narrative there, the thing that struck me was that there's a lot of emphasis on the fact that Jesus is God of all creation and the Lord over the sea. But there's also a theme here as well that he is fully human, in that he is asleep in the boat.
Yes. And again, of course, there's a model for us there that, you know, his humanity, technically speaking, would be as vulnerable to the wind and the waves as the humanity of the rest of the disciples.
You know, yes.
His body, his physical body, was composed exactly the same way. But the point is here is he's trusting in God.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things, of course, there. It's not just that he himself is God, but he is trusting in God, in his humanity. So, and that's what he's challenging them to do, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. He's challenging them to see that God has power over the winds and the waves, so he has power over everything, even sin and death, as we see later on. But the disciples, we might be kind of saying, well, would we be the same as the disciples in this situation, or would we, like, we might think ourselves as being super spiritual and, you know, able to not to be unfazed and unpanicked in the midst of a terrible storm on the Sea of Galilee. I think that would be a bit supercilious of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's always easy, sort of in the abstract, to say, well, if I was in that situation, here's what I would do. But I think the point here is that they already are believers in Jesus. They have left all and followed him.
Yeah.
They have seen him demonstrate who he is on numerous occasions. And yet when a different situation comes along that they're not prepared for, it's as though everything that they know suddenly disappears, or the implications of what they know or what they should do based on what they know just doesn't actually happen.
Yeah.
And I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you learn a lot of things in books and then it comes to the reality of trying to put it into practice, it's a whole different ballgame.
But it's worse than that, because they had learned in books in that sense. They had learned it by being with them, hadn't they?
Yeah.
You know, and similarly, if we're Christians, it's not simply that we're taking this on second hand. You know, not even that I've read it simply in the Bible or I've read it in a Christian biography. We've seen the Lord do things in our own lives.
Yes.
And yet, very often, a lot of that doesn't seem to be brought back to memory whenever we are in a crisis situation.
Yeah, we tend to hyper focus on what's happening immediately in front of us without seeing the bigger picture, and so what happens is we get so caught up in the moment of what is happening that we forget that just because it seems outside of our control, we think that it's outside of God's control.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me here was a certain parallel between the disciples there and, you know, the Jews in the Exodus experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't just God just demonstrated once, you know, who he was. He was continually demonstrating who he was in so many different ways, you know, through the plagues, through bringing them through the Red Sea, providing the water, providing the manna, and so on and so on and
yeah.
so on. And yet, whenever the next crisis would come, you know,
yeah. Why did you bring us into the desert to starve? Why did you bring us into the desert to die of thirst? You know, it's like they've seen so many things happen, and yet time and time again they start grumbling at Moses for bringing them out of Egypt.
It's too much like us, I think.
I think you're right, Michael. I think if we were honest and we took a long, hard look at our own lives and our own selves, we might never say these things, but we would actually, that's actually how we think.
But I think there's, when we're saying, you know, that the challenge going out from this about who Jesus is and how to respond to him, of course it's coming to people who don't believe at all, but it's also coming to us who do believe, but, you know, don't always follow through. Mm.
Yeah, I think the two questions that we're left with at the end of this text are the questions that we need to ask ourselves, and you know, that everybody listening needs to ask themselves as well. And that is, you know, the question at the very end that the disciples ask is, who then is this? Who is this person that can command the sea and the winds and they stop? And then also the question that Jesus kind of rhetorically asks them is, where is your faith? And it's actually these two questions that Luke goes on to answer in the next couple of stories. Because so first he has, where is your faith? Then they ask, you know, who is this? Well, what are the next stories about? Well, now we go to who is this? The demons answer. They say, well, you're Jesus, the Son of God, right? Yeah. The Son of the Most High God. They have an answer for who this is. And then right after that, you've got these stories about faith, and they're both Gentiles. It's, you know, Jairus' daughter has died, that he comes to him, he has faith. The woman who was ill for 12 years, she has faith. And then you come to Herod later on in chapter 9, and Herod is wondering, who is this again? Is it Elijah? Is it John the Baptist? Then you got another story about faith, you know, feeding the 5,000. And then you finally, you come to Peter's confession of who this is. Well, this is the Christ. And so everything that comes after this is kind of answering this question, who is this man? And, you know, what type of faith do we have? And I think that's the question that we need to be asking ourselves is, do we see Jesus for who he is? And do we have faith in him, just like Jairus did, just like this lady, that we would be willing to push through a crowd just to touch his garment, that we might be healed?
Yeah, because when we're asked that question, who is this, it's not an academic question, because it's asked in the context of who he's claiming to be.
That's right.
Is he really who he's claiming to be?
That's right.
And therefore, what's the correct response?
That's right. And as we go through the entire gospel, we know that Jesus, you know, after he's crucified, he rises again, and now he's ascended, and now he's taken his throne and is the king over the entire universe. And so, you know, who is this? Who is this one that they're talking about? They may not realize it in full yet, but this is the king of the entire universe who demands our allegiance and our obedience and our trust in him for everything.
It's funny because when he comes through this ultimate experience, including that which is the sign of Jonah, he makes this claim to the disciples, which is obviously all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Go into all the world.
Yeah.
So go to all the nations now.
That's right.
This is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is exactly, I mean, now we're coming all the way back kind of around to what I was saying earlier, is that here now is the way in which the nations, the Gentiles, will be brought into God's people, is by those who trust in him, now going out into the world and preaching this message that sounds foolish to many, but a stumbling block to many, is that, well, the Messiah who died on a cross is actually raised up and is now the king of the universe. So be prepared. You need to worship him and follow him. And in trusting in him, your sins will be forgiven, and that God will have punished Jesus in your place if you put your faith in him.
Mm-hmm. And there's that sort of parallel between the and it's there in Psalm 65, you know, you referred to it earlier, the noise of the seas and the tumult of the peoples.
Mm.
You know, when Jesus speaks to the sea, it resumes what it was created for. And when he speaks to us, our tumult, our confusion, our rebellion subsides, and we become who we were created to be.
That's right, yeah. As we are being ever conformed into who we were supposed to be, even now into the image of Jesus, we realize that so much of our problems is because of our own sin and our own desire to pursue our own self autonomy rather than bowing the knee to Jesus.
Could we go so far as to say that what the gospel does is it brings humanity back to its very purpose?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
It's not just that it changes us here and there, but it actually totally transforms us into what we're actually supposed to be.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I think Paul describes it as those who have faith in Jesus, that they become a new creation. And so the whole, all of history is moving toward that one day God will recreate the heavens and the earth. There will be a new heavens and a new earth. And there will be a population that loves God, follows after him, has placed their faith in Jesus. And so when you place your faith in Jesus, you become a part of that new creation, and you're now becoming who you were meant to be.
I'm looking at the clock, Kevin, and again, we've kind of run out of time. So.
Yeah, as usual, the clock is not our friend on this show, but we do encourage you to listen to the podcast listen to the shows that are coming up next on Shades of Green with Jimmy Neary, and later on the repeat of Town Talk from this morning. But it just remains for me to say good night.
And just to remind you before we go, if you do want a Bible, you can apply to us. You can contact us through the website and we'll be sure to get one to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You can leave a message, leave your name and address and we'll get one to you. But we just want to say good night and God bless and thank you for listening. And we close with a song which is My Hope is in the Lord. And this was actually sung by One Purpose, a group from Texas who were singing in the Fairways Hotel in here in Dundalk. So this is My Hope is in the Lord.
Say